Welcome to the What Dreamers Do podcast. I'm your host, Carla Gover, an Appalachian musician, flatfoot dancer, mama, creative, and dreamer from Kentucky. I'm on a mission to inspire others to realize their dreams and live their most creative lives. Grab you a mason jar full of sweet tea or something a little stronger and pull up a chair, because it's time to get your dream on. Who's been following you? Because that's what dreamers do.
Hey guys, I'm really excited about this episode where I had the chance to meet and talk with Stephen Smith, a veteran clogger from here in our Kentucky music and dance scene with a career that spans three decades. I really enjoyed learning more about the evolution of the dance scene here in Kentucky since the 70s, and this is also going to be a great episode if you're interested in the differences in comparing the various styles of Appalachian percussive dance, including clogging, contemporary clogging, traditional clogging, flatfooting, and more. So stick around. We're going to discuss all of those things, and you're going to get to meet a really sweet and special soul here in Kentucky.
Welcome, Dreamers, to another episode of the What Dreamers Do podcast. And I am so pleased to be here with my new friend and fellow Kentuckian, fellow clogger, dancer, Steve Smith. Do you prefer Stephen or Steve?
Steve is great. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thanks so much for being here with us.
You're welcome. I'm excited.
Yeah, I'm really excited to hear more. And I'm just diving right in because I haven't wanted to talk to you for a long time. I'm excited to hear some of the stuff you know, because, you know, you've been dancing for a long time and you've been on the scene a long time in Kentucky. And I have so many questions, but maybe a good place to start would be if you want to just kind of give us a little bit of background about where you're from and how you got started dancing and those kinds of things.
Yeah, I grew up in the western part of the state in Owensboro, came to UK in central Kentucky. And when I was 25, me and my wife went camping at Natural Bridge State Park. We were in the tent, it was dark, and we heard this music far off. And it sounded like country music. We were rock and roll fans at the time. And we thought, oh, okay, let's go see what this is. And we walked over onto a place called Hoedown Island at Natural Bridge State Park. Bleachers all around, a caller's building on the side. Richard Jett was the caller. He's done this for many years. Mm-hmm. And we watched some of the Western square dancers with the frilly skirts and so forth. And we, you know, it was okay. And we got ready to leave. And he said, well, let's call out the cloggers. Let's do a freestyle. And so all these people lined up from 7 years to 80. And he put on Rocky Top and they went out one by one and danced. And my eyes just popped out of my head. I thought, oh my God, look what these people can do. It was so athletic. I'd never even seen clogging before, never even heard of clogging before. And never dreamed I could do anything like that. But we had fun watching. We did a big set with some mountain figures. And I said, you know, it'd be great if we could just learn a basic step. So we went back to Lexington and found a retired agricultural professor named Carl Clark. And he had a team called the, oh boy, what were they called? The Kentucky Heritage Dancers.
Wow.
They met three times a week. They did a lot of Kentucky Heritage Dance squares, the Kentucky running set. And they did a clogging. They had taps on their shoes. And they did a basic clogging step through some of those figures. So we learned a basic step. And I pretty much took to it like a fish out of water. I was putting off doing a dissertation, and this was a great distraction. So I started putting a lot of time into it. And my wife and I we heard about a competition in Fontana, North Carolina. So we got in our little Rambler and went through that torturous 11-mile curve to get there. Oh, it's such a tough drive. But we got there, and I watched a clogging competition. And I got a package of Post-it notes, and I started making my own notation so I could remember the steps I was seeing. And I left with my pocket stuffed full of all these things. I was so excited. So I went home and started teaching some of them to the group. And that was fine for a while, but it began to move outside the confines of what the group was supposed to be. Mm-hmm. So eventually we parted ways. It was amicable, but I wanted to learn more and I wanted to teach more. Mm-hmm. Should I keep going?
Yes. It's kind of what we would say back home in Eastern Kentucky is he was eat up with it.
Mm-hmm. Ate up is right. Yeah. And I started teaching for Parks and Recreation. And I had big classes. Word got around somehow. I was a good teacher. And I got big classes, but they wouldn't pay me anymore because I had big classes. They paid me what they paid people to teach. And I said, well, this is.
I know that one. I have been familiar with that scenario before.
Yeah. So I found a dance hall. It's in the top of a place called the Kitchen Planning Center. It was a big 5,000 square foot dance hall. It was over a wooden beam, so it had some give in the floor, which was great. It was linoleum tile. It was really nice to dance on. I started teaching, and this was probably in 82, 83. And we had cheap classes, and we had this thing where if you bring me three dancers, you get 10 weeks free. And we just were bombarded with students. I literally would have 60, 70, 80 new students every 10 weeks. It was just crazy.
So do you have any sense of what was driving the popularity of the dance form at that time?
There was a strong Western square dance contingent, a lot of Western dance groups. I danced at a couple of those doing exhibitions. Mm-hmm. And one of the callers was fond of me and connected. And I think the word just got out. So we got lots of people who were doing Western square dancing. We got lots of people who were doing lion dancing. And people just wanted to see what it was about. And, you know, it was one of the coolest things I've ever done was to have those classes, because people of all socioeconomic levels, all different kinds of faith and political beliefs would come together. There was never any discord. It was like, come together, let's dance to upbeat music. Let's walk in tired from the day, but let's leave feeling great. And that's what happened with people. It was just a really good structure.
Well, that's the beautiful thing about the arts, is the way it connects people together. And, you know, like you said, it makes us forget about whatever socio-political, religious divisions that we have. But I have to just back up for a minute and tell you that where I grew up in Letcher County, I was exposed to some steps at the square dance. You know, there would always be some people at the square dance doing shuffle, step, ball, change, you know, over in the corner. And then sometimes down at the little dry goods store, they would put down bales of hay, and this guy named Old Joe Clark would come and do this, what I would now call probably more like flat footing, really old timey. And I would get up and try to dance with him, but it was really Hoedown Island, because my mother loved going to Natural Bridge, and we went over there one day, and sure enough, at the end, when Richard Jett, I must have been 5 years old. Maybe it was even the same night you were there. You know, I don't know. You might not be that much older than me, but...
oh, yes, I am.
But when we were... when he said, oh, everybody come out on the floor, and I did not know what I was doing, but I was like, yes, I'm getting out there. And it was actually many years before I learned very many steps after that. But that definitely put that fire in my heart about wanting to learn to make sounds that would help me express the joy I felt when I was listening to the music.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And I think Lexington is close enough to Eastern Kentucky that I pulled quite a few people who knew some basic steps and they wanted to learn more. In ways that just weren't available to them in their locales.
Right. Yeah. Because in a small town, it's an issue even today. There's people that know how to dance and there's dancers, but there's often not a lot of formal instruction still.
Yeah.
But I had one question about that time. Cause so obviously you went to a competition and you're just soaking up the steps and writing them on post-it notes. But did you have any other particular teachers or mentors that you were learning from in those early days?
Well, the Stanley Brothers advertised for Martha White Flour, so I'm going to do a sort of cooking advertisement here to support this podcast. I have a confession to make. I love to cook from scratch, but many nights these days, I'm only cooking for my son and myself. When I'm busy and tired, sometimes it's a little bit too easy to get takeout, so I decided to try some of those meal kit boxes that I saw advertised, and I went through four different ones until I found the one that I like best, Home Chef. Every week, I get to pick four meals that I think my family would like, and they send the ingredients right to my door. This isn't processed food either. It's just healthy meats, fresh vegetables, and grains that I prepare. It usually takes me 30 minutes or less to get supper on the table, and my picky son loves every meal. Plus, it's way cheaper than takeout. If you want to try it out, just go to carlagover.com/supper. I don't get paid for this endorsement. I just truly like the product. And if you sign up using my link, they will send me credits toward my own boxes. And with an almost 13-year-old boy in the house, I could use them. Plus, all that good food is going to help me keep recording this podcast for you. Just do me a favor and don't tell Granny.
Well, Richard Jett was certainly a mentor for how to run a fun dance. And that was a part of what I really enjoyed doing was keeping big set figures, a few traditional squares, certainly teaching people to feel comfortable freestyling, which people in structured classes have trouble with because they like doing the same step at the same time, you know. So he was a mentor in a lot of ways. He was a gentle guy, and he was just good with people. So I really appreciate him. I had a cohort in arms, Charlie Burns. He was the guy who would do many workshops with me later on. He was an IBMer and older than me, but very enthusiastic about clogging. And mostly my mentors. I mean, I give credit to everything I've done to good dancers. I learned from good dancers.
So just Burton people Edwards that you would see.
From Maggie Valley, Mike Burton Cassidy, Edwards. Who, from Maggie Valley, Western North Carolina. And Ira Bernstein, I got interested in Flatfoot, and Ira was a big help. And Talking Feet, the video, I took so much from that video. It was
amazing video.
Yeah. We had the Piddle Puppets one time for a workshop. And so we were trading steps with Eileen and Rodney Carson and Rodney Sutton. We went to Pine Woods. We were invited to Pine Woods 1 year, learned a few things there. And then the other live music festivals that I did were the ones at the Ozark Folk Center in Mountain View, Arkansas, which were wonderful. So most of what I did was to canned music, recorded music. That was just what I grew up with. And but I really liked live music, and I liked freestyling, and I liked knowing how to call big sets and square. So I tried to keep my feet in both camps, but I, most of what I did was, you know, I would put under the label of modern clogging.
Right. Contemporary clogging, modern clogging. Some people call it white shoe clogging.
White shoe clogging, you know, and I went and I switched to white shoes at some point, would only wear black. But I moved out of that, but yeah, I tried to straddle both genres. And Ira Bernstein helped me get a pair of shoes that made it much easier to really do good flat footing. That was a lot of fun.
Did you have the Capizio K360s or the Sanders? I know those are the two that he liked.
I don't know. There was somebody who would custom make them that he had. I mean, it was a pretty specialized.
He had those Sanders shoes from London, and they're still making them today.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. And I learned the waltz clog, and I had some waltz clog shoes made. Yeah.
Oh, that's fun. The wooden soles, the English clogs.
Yeah.
Well, this is probably a good moment to have the discussion. And this is always, and I'm sure this has been the same case for you, but people are always either wanting to come up to me and saying, well, what's the difference between flat footing and clogging, buck dance? Or I say something on stage or when I'm given a workshop and they want to come up and correct me and tell me why I'm wrong, that no, that's not actually flat footing, or no, that's not actually clogging. So I just like to ask that question of everybody and see what they say about it. So what, how do you think about the differences in this, in the styles you do, and also those broader categories that people use, like buck dance, flat footing, clogging?
Yeah, I love this question. And I don't get too hung up on, I mean, you have to give what you do a name. But there are four distinct styles. And I've learned, dabbled in all of them. And I give them a different name. And mostly other people have given them that name. I've said, okay, we'll call it that. Mm-hmm. So clogging, drag slide clogging is what I call clogging. There's drag, a constant up and down movement. You know, if you're shuffling, your heels are clicking going forward. Often toes are popping on the way back.
Heel shuffle. You're talking about a heel shuffle.
Okay.
I'm asking you. So the shuffle is not made with the toe-toe. It's a heel toe?
Yeah, but it's not a double toe. It's not a double sound. It's pop, plop, 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 plop.
Da 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 and a one.
No, no, not a double toe. Not a... Da-da-da. It's okay. just shuffling, bending your legs, straightening your legs, bending and straightening, but getting a sound on each one of those. Okay. So when I do clogging, the foot that's on the floor is, for me, is the timekeeper. It's always making...
It's the downbeat.
It's always got the downbeat with the heel.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's getting the upbeat with the toe pop, but always that heel. So that up and down, constant, steady up and down, is what I call shuffle clogging. And everything I learned in the beginning was that. And then I saw Burton Edwards, and I competed against Burton Edwards, and he has his own style. I beat him once. And he does lots of things, but one of the things he did that I had never seen, and he began to teach it, and he called it a pitter-patter step. But he would heel toe, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. So
Eileen and Rodney do pity pats. Same, okay. Maybe that's the same thing.
Between heel and toe or two toes?
So you're going left toe, right heel. So you're alternating da 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 da, pity, 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 pat. But it's like, you know, right, left, right, left, right, left, right, left, right, left.
You're getting two sounds on each foot, right? Same foot?
But you're,
or is that different?
It's like you put down your right toe and then you do your left foot and then you put it on your left toe.
Okay, that's different.
Right heel. Okay, so it's different. So this pitter patter. Yeah,
so this would be using your terminology would be shuffle step, heel ball, heel ball. Heel ball on the right, heel ball on the left. So it's da 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 da, seven beats. Shuffle, ball, heel step.
I can see that we're
going
to have to get together in person at some point. So we can communicate about this.
Well, the videos will be on YouTube tomorrow. You can see.
Awesome. So exciting. Okay.
So that's the second style. The third style is flat foot, which you're very familiar with. And the fourth style, I would say, had a huge, it's probably very predominant in contemporary clogging, certainly in competition, is a heavy Canadian step dancing emphasis.
With the... shuffle pity pity step, shuffle pity pity.
Yeah, and the double doubles. Da 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 da. That's had a huge influence. So those four styles, I went through all of those and took pieces of all of those and tried to teach steps from all those four styles.
So would you say that when you first started the, what did you call it? Shuffle drag clogging? Heel drag, what did you call it?
Shuffle clogging. Yeah.
So would you say that one was more predominant at the early part of your career? And then as time went on, the more French Canadian influence came in?
Or? So it was shuffle clogging and then buck and then flat foot, got exposure to more flat foot and then Canadian emphasis. They invited Judy Weymouth, who is a national champion from Canada, to come to the National Clogging Convention. And she had her step dancers and they did step dancing and people went, oh my God, show me, show me. And so they borrowed some of the influences. We certainly don't Canadian step dance, but there were pieces that were integrated in the clogging. So if I do a freestyle right now, you'll see all four of those in a freestyle, all four of those influences typically, because they work really well together.
And when you're freestyling, that's the nature of it. You just draw in whatever influence you have. You know, if you see a tap dancer who also flat foots freestyling, they'll put a few tappy things in there.
That's right. Yeah. Do what you know.
That, That's interesting to think about the fact that maybe a French Canadian person coming to the National Clogging Conference could have contributed to that style being more prevalent in contemporary clogging. Because I've always wondered, because I was in Eileen's dance company that she had after Footworks. I mean, after Fiddle Puppets, and it was called Footworks. Uh-huh. And we did a variety of dances, and we did one French Canadian dance. But then I was also back home in Kentucky. I was in a white shoe group, and it, our basic and our rise and shine and everything was out. It had like a lot of French Canadian in it. And I always wondered how did this get all the way to Kentucky? Because it seemed so like what I'd seen from up there.
And you know, if you think about clogging, it's an amalgam of several dance influences from, you know, different parts of the country, Africa, Ireland, and so forth. And it continues to evolve, at least mm-hmm. contemporary clogging.
Well, there are a lot of people that want to try to be purists, both in music and dance. And especially if you're in that, I always tell my students, because I have students that like to go to festivals, and they might want to go to like Galax or Mount Airy and enter the flat footing competition. And I always at least try to give them, all right, if you're going to enter the flat footing competition, do not do any shuffles. We're going to learn shuffles because I do shuffles. And, you know, I like you said, I do what most people would probably consider a mix of flat footing and like old fashioned style clogging. But mm-hmm. At those competitions, they get so rigorous, like your feet can't be over 6 inches off the floor.
Yes.
And so you have, if you want to play those games, you have to play by their rules.
Right.
But with music and dancing, and I try to tell people this a lot, you know, when I grew up in Eastern Kentucky, I was around a lot of great fiddle and banjo players, and they played what I now know to be a variety of what are considered distinct styles. But for instance, the person that I learned banjo from, he played two finger style. He played bluegrass. He played old time clawhammer. He did not use those categories. You know, he didn't. And it wasn't until I grew up and like went outside the region that I began to encounter people who were very rigid in their, oh, I don't do bluegrass. I'm just old time. Mm. Or, you know, I'm an old time banjo player. I don't listen to bluegrass. And it was just like, what? Like the categories sometimes seem kind of artificial to me.
Yeah. I'm not wired to be a purist. I'm an integrator. So, and yeah. Try to be an innovator. So I'm more progressive, I guess, in nature, but I appreciate the ode and I want to learn the ode, but I don't want to stop progression. So.
Right. Because that's not art. It's just right. Frozen in time, right? Is it?
Uh-huh. So one of the big changes, and I think I got in at just the kind of the right time mm-hmm. in the sense of getting some notoriety, is we began to create a notation for steps where people could look at a sheet and follow the sheet, the notation. I mean, most people learn by watching historically other people dance, but to be able to create a notation that allowed someone who didn't see the dance to read and go, oh, I can learn this from the sheet, was different. And we would hand those out in our classes and people would come back and we would do routines to music. And that was popular because most people are like sheep. They like to be led and they had like the comfort of everybody doing the same thing at the same time. So yeah, I think that's part of why classes were popular.
Yeah. And I think we also have sort of a cultural inhibition to overcome. And I don't know if it's because our country was so heavily influenced by Puritans or what, but I've traveled a lot and I've noticed that in a lot of societies, dancing is a lot more natural and a lot more integrated into everyday life. And I feel like we have a larger hurdle of self-consciousness. Most people have an internalized kind of fear, shame, self-consciousness that they've got to get over. And so, you know, anything that you can do to get people to come out of their shell, you know, we have sort of a idea, I think, sometimes in the United States that only the professionals should do it. You know, if you're not good, mm-hmm. then you shouldn't get up and do it. Whereas, you know, this is folk dance and folk music, and that means that folks are supposed to do it. And I think the cue sheets can be like that, probably. They can be sort of a like a security blanket for people. But I do, my end goal in my teaching that I love is to help people, like you said, freestyle, because a lot of people, they'll come to me from a clogging background and they know tons of routines, but they never learned how to freestyle. And
exactly.
So I spend a lot of time like, how can we have a relationship with this fiddle tune? And how can we think about learning this handful of steps that we can really feel comfortable with so we can mix and match and, you know, put them together. So I enjoy that process. I think it's free.
It was a part of my beginning clogging class that you had to learn how to freestyle. And I would just get everybody on the floor. There was usually a good crowd, so it's not like anybody's going to be looking at any one person. And went through several, had several tricks up my sleeve to get people comfortable. And by the end of it, they were hooping and hollering and dancing. But still, they preferred their routines. But I wanted them to be able to do it. You know, if they went to a dance club or a party or something, so they would feel confident enough they could just get up and dance if their feet wanted to do that. So,
amen.
Yeah,
you know, sometimes to me, when a fiddle tune gets to a certain level of goodness, it's the only logical response. You just feel like you're going to explode. It's so good, and you've got to have some kind of defense. And knowing these dance steps, that's how you cope with it.
Yeah. Oh my God, I had that experience. I ruptured my plantar fascia about a year and a half ago, and could hardly walk. And I was in Owensboro, and they had an outdoor band. They were playing some hot music, and it was all I could do to just keep myself from going out and hurting myself, because I so wanted to move to the music.
Well, are you recovered now? How is your foot?
I am. Yeah, I am. Pickleball's the blame.
Oh no.
Yeah. Well,
I'm glad that you were able to have a recovery. And so I didn't realize that you were also a dance caller. Is that something that you ever do anymore, or?
Not anymore. People would have me for party or after party celebrations. Mm-hmm. Did some of that. We would have fun dances, we called them. They were a mixture of calling and routine dances. We'd have graduation dances. But I always had some of the calling as a piece of it. And most people went along with it. I wouldn't say most people favored it. They liked the routines, but I wanted that to be a part of it. So I kept it.
Well, to me, that seems very natural, because my earliest dance experiences were at the Carcassonne Community Center in Letcher County. Have you ever made it down there?
No.
It's a really special place. They've had a square dance going on for, I don't know how many decades, a monthly square dance. And it was in, it was in like a 2-room community center, kind of schoolhouse building with a wood stove. And it was always Marion Sumner and Lee Sexton playing the music. And a lot of times Charlie Whitaker calling. I don't know if you ever met him, but he was one of our big callers with those, like you said, the mountain. Some people call it the mountain sets in the circle style dances.
Yeah.
But we were always square dancing, but there would always be a few people doing the basic step in the figure. And then also a few people over to the side just doing steps. And so to me, that seems like the most natural thing, to have the circles and the squares and the percussive dance at the same time.
Yeah. It's amazing how where you grew up affects how much that affects your style and what you're drawn to, because I had never seen it. For example, you grew up with seeing it. Mm-hmm. First time I saw it, I was 25 years old, no background. And it was, you know, the Richard Jett version, Hold Down Island. And so, you know, we start from different places and take what we know and move forward with it.
Well, and it's fascinating how different the styles are in Tennessee and North Carolina.
Yeah.
And then like different steps, same steps will be called different things in different places, or.
Yep.
North Carolina and Tennessee are fairly different looking styles to me, you know, now that I've traveled around and seen them. It's just, I think it's fascinating.
Yeah.
Well, I have a few more questions. I know we're running out of time here, but why don't you tell us a little bit about what you're putting on those, what the YouTube videos that you're going to be sharing are like?
So my wife and I did several duets. These are not first class videos or videos that people shot. and some of them are decent, and some are just, you know, somebody's taking a shot. But the duets, we have, I think, 5 duets. I've got a significant number of individual performances and mostly freestyle. I guess they're all freestyle, but the different styles, waltz clog, double doubles, scuffets and triplets, which is more Canadian based, buck dance videos, shuffle clogging, and then flatfoot. I've got demonstrations. And then I actually, there are 15 videos and they're 2 hours long. So there's 30 hours of instruction on the YouTube channel. It's crazy.
Wow. So it's a mix of instruction and then performances.
Yeah.
As you say.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So there's 30, yeah, there's 15 tapes of just instruction, but then there are clips of performances as well. And there's even
so
one.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Are the instructional ones, how long are they? Are they in little sections or is it just like a whole hour or?
So they're 2 hours long, each video. And what I've done is I've timestamped them and put chapter links at the bottom. So you can scroll your cursor and see where every step starts and what the name of it is.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
Okay. Yeah. So that breaks it up. I was going to say there's even this, not a very good recording at all, but just the phenomenon of being in South Korea. My second son married a South Korean, met her in dental school in Lexington, and they do entertainment in the middle of their weddings.
Mm.
So she wanted us to do a clogging routine. So me and my oldest son, who does clog dance, wrote a routine to a K-pop song, a popular K-pop song. And in the middle of the wedding, and my son and his bride are standing there, and the minister, I'm not sure what it was called, was to the side, and it was time for entertainment. And they had a singer, and then we did our routine. And they had lights flashing on the stage, and people were clapping. They loved it. They'd never seen clogging in any form or fashion. So, you know, it's just fun to do really different stuff like that. And
go ahead.
Well, thinking about South Korea reminds me of Australia, and modern clogging is quite big in Australia. Mm-hmm. But the very first person who taught it learned only from my videos. We had never met. And it got fairly big, and she wanted to have me over. And I said, look, I've got 2 young kids. If I come, I want to stay a while. And so I want to bring my whole family. And so they raised money for 5 years and flew us over, and we had a great time. Yeah. It was really cool.
It is really cool. I have had the thought over and over again, you know, I'll be standing on a stage. Last summer it was in Serbia or, you know, Scotland. And I'm, you know, standing there with my banjo.
Yeah.
Doing the thing that I probably got made fun of, you know, for when I was like being from Eastern Kentucky, and it's like taking me all over the world. And it is so amazing, you know, the doors that it can open. It's a real blessing to be part of it.
Mm-hmm. And one of the most tender times was when I was in Prague and I stayed in somebody's apartment. They were communist built apartments. Mm-hmm. That wall had just been torn down. They had no vacuum cleaner. You take your shoes off at the door, and they had very little running water for bathing. So mm-hmm. that was interesting and an adaptation. And they didn't speak English. The dancers didn't speak English. And mm-hmm. so I did the whole workshop just showing.
Mm-hmm.
But it special bonds were created, and I just cried my eyes out at the airport when I was taken off. Which mm-hmm. I've never done before. But I felt so close, and they were so appreciative, and to realize that we could communicate without words. It was amazing.
It's a language. It's definitely language.
There was one translator, but most of the time she wasn't available. So
yeah.
It's really
well,
cool.
I had a sweet kind of similar experience when I was teaching at a middle school in Los Angeles, and this was years ago. And it was right after the rapper Tupac Shakur had died. And this middle school was so diverse. I think there might have been about 12% white kids, and the rest were a mix of Hispanic, Black, Asian. Mm-hmm. And they were all just the coolest kids because they lived in the coolest city. You know, they're from LA and they were so diverse and multicultural. And I started every step I showed them, they would say, well, that's like this hip hop step. And so we wound up doing a hip hop clog piece to a Tupac Shakur song with a bunch of eighth graders, and they absolutely slayed it.
Yes.
I wish I had video of that. They were teaching me as much as I was teaching them, if not more.
That's beautiful. I think one of the reasons contemporary clogging has continued to thrive is they dance to contemporary music.
Right.
Because anything with a beat, you can essentially dance to. So first it was, for me, it was bluegrass and country. And then it was some old rock and roll songs. And then it was mm-hmm. pop. And then the kids were doing dancing to hip hop. So it's just, mm-hmm. you know, to keep young people interested, it really helps to teach to their music. Yeah.
That's true. Well, and it's an interesting comparison to Irish dance. Of course, it's hard to compare the United States and Ireland because we're like a whole lot, many, many times larger than they are. But the Irish government, I've been over to Ireland for the last few years in a row, and we're going back this summer, and I've been able to hang out with some dancers over there. And I'm just amazed by how much funding the government puts behind their traditional music and dance. And there are definitely Irish dancers that are innovating within the style and branching out and doing it to different styles of music and whatnot. But there's a big emphasis on preserving Irish traditional music and dance. And so it's interesting.
Yep.
I love what a popular part of the culture it is. And I think one thing about over there within the country is they don't seem to have the stigma associated with it, at least not now, that is sometimes associated with clogging. Because, you know, unfortunately, stereotypes about hillbillies sometimes bleed over into stereotypes about clogging. And, you know, you do that hillbilly dance style. And, you know, part of my life's work and mission has been to hopefully be a more accurate representation of Kentucky culture and dance and music than Hollywood often provides people.
Yes.
Because I really believe that Kentuckians and people from Appalachia should be a larger part of who's representing our region instead of actors representing our region or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I do think we have to fight against a little bit as cloggers, some of the stereotypes about the region.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
So.
Then I had the reverse experience once in class. I used to have a t-shirt that says, I'm a psychologist. It says psychologist. And so this middle-aged guy came up and he was very enthused about dancing. And he said, that's an odd name. He says, where did you get that? I said, oh, I'm also a psychologist. And his face just fell. He said, oh, I didn't know you or somebody like that. And he never came back. So
yeah, like you're not authentic if you do something.
Exactly.
We posted my daughter plays the fiddle in a old time band with me. And she loves to color her hair different colors. And so at this point in time, it was green. And we made this video of this traditional tune and posted it. And somebody on YouTube was like, that's not very Appalachian. And I'm like, you know, we can be psychologists and have green hair too here in Kentucky. But people want you to play to the stereotype. They want you to wear calico and you know, have low IQs and just all this.
What's hilarious is I go back and watch these ancient videos I'm putting up, is how much I code switched my accent to be more country than it typically was. Because I was teaching a lot of country folk, by and large, not always, but maybe that was a stereotype I had in my head as well. But boy, I sound like I grew up a little further east than I did.
Western Kentuckians have a Kentucky accent too.
Yeah.
The thing I've noticed about code switching, because I do it big time. And I would say that I code switch into my like less twangy accent, that it feels like the less at home accent, like I'm kind of doing right now without thinking about it. Because anytime when I'm in an environment where I want to be taken seriously, or, you know, where there's a chance where people I don't know might think that I'm less intelligent or something, I don't even think about it. I just try to smooth out the long I's and, you know, the vocabulary, the more obscure vocabulary words and stuff like that. That's, you know, code switching, I think sometimes is perceived as like you're being inauthentic when you're in one accent or the other. But I don't think that's true. I just think humans are very adaptable creatures, and code switching is part of surviving and thriving when you move between social settings.
And you want to be accepted and heard by the audience you're in front of. And so you adapt to that audience sometimes.
Well, I would have guessed that you have a Kentucky accent. I mean, it's a soft, soft accent, but I don't think you're just making it up.
It's a little different in the videos.
Yeah.
You'll see.
Well, you know, our former poet laureate, Crystal Wilkinson, who just has, by the way, has this awesome book that just came out called Praise Song for the Kitchen Ghost, which is about cooking in Black Appalachia and meals and her family. But she was talking about how she was listening back through YouTube videos to try to get a clip, because her publicist wanted a clip to use for some particular purpose. And she was marveling at, you know, how some interviews she sounded like cornbread, and some interviews she sounded like, you know, just a totally erudite college professor with no awareness at any, you know, that she was doing one time and one the other. And I think that's really common when, especially when you grow up with an accent that has a stigma associated with it. Mm-hmm. I know speakers of Black vernacular English do the same thing. They'll have one accent that they'll code switch for formal settings, and one family code switch.
Absolutely.
It's just, I don't know, but it's interesting. Well, I have like two more quick questions, bonus round questions, if that's okay.
Bonus round.
What is there anything that you feel like people get wrong about this style of dancing, or what do you want people to know about the styles of dance you do? Flat footing, clogging, buck dance, what have you?
What do they get wrong about it? I don't know, because I really don't have these little boxes so much, even though my videos say this, you know, here's buck styling, here's flat foot styling. I really don't have those rigid boxes. So the only thing I hear people say sometimes, oh, that's tap dancing. That's like tap dancing. Pretty different than tap dancing. Yeah. Quite different than tap. Yeah.
Every elementary school child that you ever dance in front of, I like your tap dancing.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, it's not tap dance.
It's not tap dance. It is percussive, but it's not tap dance.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's about it.
I
just think, you know, I'm grateful for the history and those who have come before me. And I'm grateful for the venues that have been open to me. And whether it's performance, whether it's social, whether it's live music, whether it's not, I think there's a place for all of it. And
I'm grateful.
I can't think of a better physical activity. Just so good for the body.
It's so much more fun than like jumping jacks.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Calisthenics or whatever.
Yeah. Go to the gym or dance. What should I pick? Choice. Right.
Well, I'm grateful for everything that you have done to keep this dance form alive and growing in our state and our community. And I'm really glad to finally get to connect with you. Hopefully we'll get to do it in person soon. And, because our listeners are a lot of creative people, One of the things I like to ask my guests is, what advice do you have for people who want to make creativity a part of their everyday life? And I think you're a good person to speak to it, since you have a career in psychology, but you've also had a lot of involvement and almost like a second career as a dancer. What advice do you have for people that want to live their best creative life?
Wow. I think, first of all, you have to dream, and you have to follow the natural pull to something. So like I said, I was in the PhD program, and I saw the performance at Hoedown Island, and there was just the energy. I was just pulled toward it. And I had a decision to make. Do I say, okay, I don't have time for this, or do I follow that, what felt like a passion at the time? Mm-hmm. And I did, and I don't regret it. It took me forever to get out of school. 1985 rolled around. My wife said, if we're going to have kids, it's got to be now. And it's time to build a house. It's time to have a baby, and it's time to finish your PhD. So all of that happened in 85. And I put it off as long as I could, because I just wanted to develop and give passion, the expression to this passion. So allowing yourself to dream a bit. You know, what would I love to do? So many people live their lives just trying to survive and get through and make ends meet, and have a lot of beliefs that I can't do that. I'm not talented enough to do that. I don't have enough money to do that. But if you can just let yourself dream, if you see something that looks great, whether it's art or woodwork or whatever, or music, and you go, oh man, I'd love to do that. See if you can't pursue it. Start small. Find somebody who's willing to teach you for free. I mean, we took clogging 3 days a week for free. There was no charge with Dr. Carl Clark. So dream, follow your instincts and your inclination, and don't be afraid to innovate. You don't have to copy what's been done before you. Learn some basics and then create new steps, create new wood pieces, create new art, create new music. There's an artist in all of us, and there's creativity, and creating is about newness. So do it, do it, do it, do it.
I love it. Ah, that's great. That's the best one yet. Well, it's been a pleasure, and I wish you all the success in whatever you're dreaming up next, whatever you're cooking up next. I'm sure you're going to always be innovating and creating in some way. And I hope to get the chance to do a little step or two somewhere with you. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Hi, thank you so much. I'd love to do that. And it's been really fun going down memory lane with my beginning and bringing it up to the present. Thank you so much.
All right. Can't wait to see your stuff on YouTube.
Okay. Take care.
Okay, I hope you enjoyed that chat with Steve as much as I did, and I am going to link to those videos he mentioned, his YouTube channel, and any other relevant links in the show notes. Meanwhile, I'm so grateful that you passed another little while with me here on the What Dreamers Do podcast, and until next time, keep dreaming.
This episode of What Dreamers Do is sponsored by the online Appalachian Flatfooting and Clogging Academy, the only course of its kind and the most comprehensive step-by-step program available for dancers learning this style. I teach beginning and intermediate students the steps and skills they need to dance to traditional mountain music so that they can be confident, joyful dancers and improvisers. Unlike others who just teach the same handful of steps or who just teach routines, I give you not only a bountiful library of steps, but a framework for understanding how the steps fit together with the music. Learn more about the Academy and get started for free with my video tutorial, The Three Essential Steps for Appalachian Flatfooting and Clogging. Visit www.carlagover.com today. It's a holy fight.